Welcome back to this weekly meeting of the Health and Safety Committee with Denver City Council. Coverage of the Health and Safety Committee starts now.
Good morning and welcome to the new Health and Safety Committee. My name is Daryl Watson. I'm honored to serve all the residents of the fine District 9. I'm also honored to be the new committee chair for health and safety. This is going to be a weekly meeting, and it will provide an opportunity for us to engage in dialogue around increasing community health and safety. I want to thank Council President for trusting myself and Vice Chair Flynn, as well as my colleagues on this committee, for stewardship of these very important discussions. Our focus on this committee will be to increase transparency in government, to educate on how your city supports actions to increase community health and safety. And this committee will keep our constituents, like my mother that's watching right now, and thanks, Ma, I know you're gonna be texting me in a second, informed and communities engaged on all of these important discussions. Today we have several action items as a block. We have one consent item. Before we begin, why don't we go around the room and have introductions of city council members, starting on my right.
Is that this way?
That's you.
Oh, I apparently don't know my right from my left. Amanda Sawyer, District 5.
Good morning. Diana Romero Campbell, Southeast Denver, District 4.
Sarah Parody, I'm one of your two council members at large.
Good morning. Paul Cashman, South Denver, District 6, and I wish your mother a good committee meeting.
Thank you.
Good morning. Serena Gonzalez Gutierrez, your other council member at large.
Jamie Torres, West Denver, District 3.
Thank you so much. And I believe we have Councilmember Flynn online.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Kevin Flynn, Council District 2 in beautiful Southwest Denver. And hi to your mom.
My mom says hi back, Councilmember. We have a block action item and a presentation, 251020. It's from the Department of Public Health and Environment. I'll hand it over to you all to introduce yourselves and roll with the presentation. There are about 20 minutes because we assume we're going to have quite a few questions from City Council members. So the floor is yours.
Perfect. Thank you all for welcoming us and giving us this opportunity to speak. We're super excited. My name is Stephanie Briggs. Apologies if on the presentation you may see the name Jess. She's out sick. I'm covering for her today. I'm the contract compliance administrator for Healthy Food for Denver's Kids, and this is my colleague, Michaela.
Hi, everyone. My name is Michaela Mullins. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm a program associate for Healthy Food for Denver's Kids. I'm good to see you all.
Hi, all. I'm not presenting, but can support with Q&A. Lauren Howe, she, her pronouns, Healthy Food for Denver's Kids program supervisor.
And we're here today to request the approval of 13 new resolutions for the Healthy Food for Denver's Kids HFDK06 board. So a quick overview of today's presentation. We'll begin with the background on the Healthy Food for Denver's Kids program and the role of our commission. And then we'll share an overview of our evaluation and funding activities, followed by a brief explanation of our compliance and contracting process. Then we'll present a request for the approval of the 13 resolutions. And finally, we'll conclude with financial details and next steps. And I'll pass it over to Michaela.
So just to set the stage of what we currently know about food insecurity in Denver, approximately 15% of Denverites are considered food insecure, with statistically higher rates among parents of children under the age of 18. Among low-income households with children under the age of 18 living at home, close to 17% of parents had to cut the size of their children's meals because there was not enough food for, or enough money for food. And we also know that the federal nutrition assistance programs, SNAP and WIC, are shifting under our current administration at the federal level. So what is Healthy Food for Denver's Kids, or HFDK? This was established because of a resident-led ballot measure, which was approved by Denver voters in 2018. This ballot measure 302 resulted in a small sales tax increase of 0.08%, or about a penny on a $10 purchase. And this established a special revenue fund for healthy food access and food-based education for Denver's youth. It was originally projected to generate around $11 million per year for a 10-year term. Our funds are collected from January 1st of 2019 through December 31st of 2028, and they must be distributed in full by December 31st, 2029. This initiative aims to help make sure kids have enough to eat while receiving hands-on education in gardening, cooking, and nutrition. Our funds must be used to purchase, or can be used to purchase, local food that's produced here in Colorado. And these funds must principally benefit Denver and its residents, since this is Denver taxpayer dollars. And it's important to note that no more than 10% of the funds can be used for city administration costs. This is a history of our program. It starts with the ballot measure, which was approved by voters in 2018, when it started collecting funds in annual funding rounds from 2020 to 2029. And HFDK's long-term vision is that all Denver kids have reliable access to nutritious and culturally diverse food and food education that helps them grow, learn, and thrive for life. This vision, the program's evaluation framework, and theory of change were all established in 2020, and they continue to be the driving force behind our annual funding opportunities. Driving the funding strategy and decision-making of the program is the HFDK Commission, which is a mayoral-appointed body of 13 volunteers. The Denver Revised Municipal Code, or DRMC, outlines the exact number of commission seats and types, which you can see is a mix of city council members. So thank you, Councilmember Paul Cashman and Diana Romero Campbell, for being on our commission. City agency leaders, nonprofit representatives, and community members. It's a racially diverse group, with more than half identifying as individuals of color, including folks with lived experience of hunger and food insecurity. The commission typically meets bi-monthly with members of the public, and grantees are always welcome to attend. And again, it's important to note that DDPHE staff provides the operational support and subject matter expertise for HFDK, including implementing the decisions and guidance that are set forth by the commission. So who's eligible for funding? Our funds are distributed through competitive grant-making process to Denver nonprofits, public schools, including DPS as a whole, and city agencies. Some examples of different program types we funded include healthy meals and snacks, food education classes on nutrition, cooking, gardening, and food justice, free food distribution, including mobile food markets and school food pantries, and SNAP and WIC outreach and enrollment. HFDK has invested in third-party evaluation support since the beginning of the initiative. And this evaluation includes both analysis of grantee reports, which are submitted on a quarterly basis, as well as a citywide macro evaluation and GIS mapping efforts that examine how population level changes in food access, food assistance, food education, and food production have changed across Denver for children and families, and how HFDK grantees have contributed to these outcomes. Lastly, both our evaluation partner and HFDK staff provide technical assistance to our grantee partners through webinars, office hours, and in-person workshops. So this data on this slide reflects approximately $86 million in grants being distributed across five cohorts of grantee partners since 2020. In 2024 alone, our grantee partners served just over 149,000 unique families or households. And collectively, since August of 2020, grantee partners have served over 47 million meals and snacks, created more than 670 new youth jobs, and distributed over 34 million pounds of food to Denver residents. So we're a little over halfway through the HFDK initiative, which, as I mentioned, is scheduled to sunset in 2029. So to commemorate this critical time in the life cycle of the program, City Council recognized HFDK through a proclamation on June 2nd. We also celebrated this milestone at the Denver Zoo on June 7th, where more than 500 community members joined HFDK staff and grantee partners for a day filled with family-friendly activities, healthy snacks, and special remarks, including by Councilmember Paul Cashman. And lastly, DDPHE released a halfway celebration video with remarks from commissioners and staff that highlights the exciting work of our grantee partners, including Clayton Early Learning, Servicios de la Raza, and the Urban Farm. And we'll share the video at the end of our presentation.
Thank you, Michaela. Here's an overview of our funding timeline since 2020, which reflects six annual funding cohorts awarded to date. Together, these rounds represent approximately $97 million in committed funding across 104 contracts. While all rounds have centered on increasing access to healthy food for Denver youth, some have had specific strategic focus. So for example, HFDK03 focused more on the early childhood education and federal nutrition assistance programs, whereas HFDK04 focused on collaboration and strong organizational partnerships. We want to highlight HFDK's longstanding practice of issuing smaller grant awards to remain responsive to community needs and to ensure that funding is accessible to smaller organizations. For instance, at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, the Commission swiftly partnered with the Colorado Blueprint to End Hunger to distribute nearly $1 million in emergency hunger relief grants to over 50 organizations. Additionally, last year, HFDK awarded close to $600,000 to address food insecurity among newcomer youth and their families. And looking ahead, we're currently in the process of awarding our next round of microgrants focused broadly on community food access, with contracts slated to begin in 2026. And we feel strongly about these microgrants just because they're designed to have less administrative burden compared to our larger RFP and a bit more flexibility. And this makes them quite more accessible for some of our smaller organizations here in Denver. This past year marked our most competitive funding cycle yet. We received 53 letters of interest, which narrowed to 32 full applications, and ultimately 17 were funded. The review process was thorough. We had 17 reviewers participating in the LOI stage, and 15 reviewers evaluated the full proposals. Each review round included two reconciliation meetings where reviewers calibrated scores using a transparent rubric that applicants had access to. Among the selected grantees for this upcoming cohort, 9 are returning from previous cohorts and 8 are considered new to the program. Okay, so here's our table summarizing our 13 resolution requests we're presenting today for your approval. Please note that on the bottom row, Center for Work, Education, and Employment, that's not going to be going through committee until next week. We had a formula error during our budget reconciliation meeting, and we realized that with that fix, it crossed the $500,000 threshold to now require City Council approval. I'll pause here for a moment. HFDK's fund remains healthy and consistent. Since the program's inception, we've maintained steady grant amounts each cohort, with an average between $10 to $15 million per cohort, with contracts typically spanning around 3 years. This breaks down to roughly $3 to $5 million allocated per year per cohort. While revenue projections from 2026 onward are slightly lower than earlier estimates from the city's budget management office, HFDK still has sufficient funds to fulfill existing commitments and to support additional grants through the end of the initiative in December of 2029. We've included projections through 2027 here to illustrate the fund's consistency and to provide insight into future grant opportunities. And please note these projections are always due to change due to sales tax revenues collected. And just for some information as well, the 2024 projected and 2025 projected are valid from BMO, I should say. The 2026 and 2027 projected amounts were done internally by us using a formula from BMO. Okay. To date, we've granted nearly $99.4 million to 113 unique organizations, and this chart shows amounts awarded per cohort to date. There is a $37 million difference between revenue and grants, and that's allocated as follows. Approximately $13.6 million is reserved for administration costs. As Michaela mentioned, the ordinance allows up to 10% of projected annual revenue for administration. That covers our personnel, our evaluation consultant, and other nominal expenses like technology and travel reimbursements. Another $6.8 million is set aside as contingency funds to cover emergencies or funding gaps, with any of those unused amounts reverting back to the HFTK fund. And lastly, $16.8 million is designated for the upcoming HFTK 07 cohort and related microgrants covering contract terms from 2026 to 2029. To ensure responsible stewardship of taxpayer dollars, us here at HFTK believe pretty strongly in upholding compliance. We've developed a comprehensive compliance framework. This includes thorough invoice monitoring, biannual risk assessments, and site visits to proactively identify and address any potential issues. We have corrective action plans in place for when necessary, and all of these measures help ensure that the funds are used in line with approved budgets and program goals. If you all would like, we would love to show you our video from our halfway celebration.
Awesome.
Okay. Let's get that up. Oh, no, not you, Sonny. Hold on. Get out of here. Okay. Full screen. I want this to be full, but I don't know that we can.
Thank you, Denver!
We're halfway through the Healthy Food for Denver's Kids 10-year program, which is set to expire in 2029. We're really excited to have made it to this point. The impact has been incredible, and we hear every day from community members how they're positively impacted by this program.
I brought bananas, we have some berries.
Healthy Food for Denver's Kids provides funding to our community partners to provide food-based education, so cooking classes, gardening lessons for youth and families.
We're making muffins and smoothies.
My son, he always wants to get into the kitchen with me, but like I'm usually in a hurry and don't really have time for that. So when we come here, I like to give them an opportunity to do the things themselves, you know, feel what it's like to get their hands dirty in the ingredients and learn how to do things themselves.
Are we gonna make some at home too?
Over the first 5 years of the initiative, we've invested close to $85 million into our community partners' work to provide healthy food access and food education for Denver's youth and families. Healthy Food for Denver's Kids began from a community-led movement. Voters approved it, and we know that they care about investing in our youth and families to ensure that they can thrive.
Healthy Food for Denver Kids really, I think, aligns well with our impact currently on the community. We provide nutrition education at these distribution events. Sometimes it's in the form of myself or our team being present there and actually having conversations and maybe doing some demonstrations of here's eat this versus that.
Healthy Food for Denver Kids was a great opportunity for us to expand resources, specifically for families, children needing that support. It's costly. It's really hard to feed a family. We want to make sure that we're providing that support, fresh fruits, vegetables, and protein. Basic rights is what Servicios works for.
Nuestro programa es para familias de bajos recursos. Entonces, este apoyo que nos da Servicios de la Raza es bien beneficioso para todas las familias, porque nosotros no sabemos si hay familias que tienen que comer o no tienen que comer, y esta ayuda que nos dan ayuda mucho.
I have a young child, and I know how important nutrition is, and what Healthy Food for Denver Kids, what the commission is able to do is really ensure that all families have access to the culturally relevant, culturally responsive, nutritious food they need. I am excited for the next 5 years to see how the commission can further support those organizations and our grantees that work in high they need high priority communities.
It means a lot to me that I'm taking care of the animals.
We provide funding to community partners to employ and train youth in practical skills in agriculture and culinary.
Yeah.
Every single person is a leader. That is 100% a fact. And each one of them has a leadership style that they're just not aware of now.
The work that they do here on the farm is major building projects, minor building projects. They take care of our animals every morning. They learn a lot about animal husbandry, basic construction.
A lot of them, this is their first job. A lot of them, this might be a job that has given them more grace than other jobs before, so where they can actually like, all right, maybe I should really start getting better. Maybe I should start trying.
We'd like to thank Denverites for voting yes on this initiative and continuing to support it through your everyday purchases. To our grantee partners for the tireless work you do on the ground every day to bring this program to life. To the families and youth who participate. To the commission for your leadership and service. And to the mayor's office and city council for your continued support of this initiative.
Here and we can open up for questions. Thank you again so much for having us. We're really happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie, Michaela, and Lauren. You can see the smiles around the table, the good work that your team is doing. I'd like to welcome Council President Sandoval to our meeting. Before we open up for questions from the queue, why don't we begin with the City Council Commissioners, Council President Pro Tem Romero Campbell and Councilmember Cashman. Any additional thoughts that you would like to share?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, again, thank you for the presentation and the lovely video. I get excited when you see families being able to benefit from the services and from the funding that comes from all of the HDFK. I was just hoping that maybe you could spend a little bit of time talking at the federal level and what that impact has been and how you've been responding to that. This last year, and kind of and some plans for future, because I think that's a really important piece.
Yeah, great question about the federal impact on the local programming. It's something that HFDK staff are trying to stay really apprised with. We are preparing our future funding strategy for our next request for proposals that we anticipate releasing either later in 2025 or early 2026. And we're really paying attention to cuts in SNAP and Medicaid and the indirect effects on programs like WIC and potentially even school meals. We know that a lot of people are probably going to fall off of those programs. It'll be difficult to keep them enrolled. And so I think our strategy is multi-part. One is to continue to double down on our investments in direct food distribution. We know that the charitable food system will continue to be further strained as more people access food pantries. And so we want to continue to invest in those particular organizations and programs, while at the same time leave it available for partners who do SNAP and WIC enrollment, who have expertise, who can navigate the changes. If they want to apply in the future to continue to enroll families, we want to make that option available. So we're really trying to stay queued up in what's going on and adjust our funding strategy to be as nimble and responsive as possible.
Thank you. I actually don't have any other questions, but
Council Pro Tem, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to go exactly where you went. I mean, at a time where the federal administration seems to be taking great joy in cutting funding to feed children and families, both within our borders and around the world. It's just an honor to be able to get up close and watch the work y'all are doing. I mean, if you just look at the statistics on the millions of meals and snacks that this organization, this small but mighty team, has put forth, it really is wonderful. And our federal administration should be ashamed of what they're doing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you both for your leadership on this really important commission and committee. In the queue, we have Councilmember Torres, Parity, and then Councilmember Flynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all so much. I have so much love for Healthy Food for Denver Kids and the impact that that you're able to make through these dollars. So thank you for all of that. Want to be sure that I'm understanding the $99.4 million awarded includes the grants that go through 2027 or 2028 with your projected numbers. You do kind of multi-year grant making, right?
Yes, that's correct. So this here shows it's actually a total of, I believe, a little bit over $114 million. And that does include what we preserved for HFDK 07 and microgrants. So there's a $16.8 million there for that.
When you have contingency, yeah, when do you roll that into what you grant out? Is it at the end of a year, or do you keep a certain amount in the bucket?
It's always kept there in the bucket. It's okay. Never planned to be used unless for emergencies. So with, I think, the landscape changing, we just like to have that to be sure if we're cut short or anything like that. But we typically don't use it. An example may be back in 2020 when we didn't plan for microgrants. Right now we have those built in. So we don't really have complete plans for using them, but again, just to safety for us.
Okay, that might be interesting to kind of think about what language or what permissiveness you have for using contingency funding, because it's not like a construction project where you don't know what cost escalation will be or something like that. So that would be interesting as we go forward. How much of the admin allowance is being used right now? You said 10% is allowed.
It's a great question. We've got about $13.6 million available for administration.
I believe we're around 8 or 9%.
Okay.
We could get an exact number for you on that.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Kind of a big picture question. You mentioned about 15% of Denverites are food insecure. In our work, I think, and when I was on the commission, part of what I was envisioning is kind of a future where we have less food insecurity. But are folks still food insecure, even though they are utilizing the programming that we are funding, so we may not actually see a drop in that insecurity based on this program exclusively. Do you get what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
I was just going to add, there's a lot of factors that go into food insecurity, and so while we're able to provide and address that need, there's a lot of other things kind of outside of HFDK. So looking at the impacts of the pandemic, the current economic uncertainty that we're experiencing, and the fact that HFDK, it really is just going towards families and youth and not quite everyone else in the Denver area that's food insecure. So I hear what you're saying, and we also know there's just some things out of our control with the program.
Yeah. I think just to add some numbers, because they're pretty staggering in terms of what's written into, I call it the big billionaire bill. There's nothing beautiful about it. Federal reduction of $186 billion over 10 years to SNAP, and cuts to WIC for kids, for the allocation for kids, it goes from $26 to $10 a month. And for pregnant, postpartum, and breastfeeding moms, it drops from $47 to $13. That's unconscionable. And there's no way we can make up that gap. So I deeply appreciate how you're spreading the dollars around how committed we are to this, and know that we've got to go back to voters at some point. So I really hope we can try to figure out both the household observation of what this is doing in the context of these just massive cuts that are coming down. So thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Torres. Councilmember Parity and Councilmember Flynn, and then Councilmember Sawyer.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And I, like everyone else, I love hearing about this program, especially, I've seen visually the food that kids get through the program. And it's just like, it can bring tears to your eyes to see that food being like put out on a table or handed out, you know, to take home. It really means a lot to me. My daughter is 7, and so she's in a lot of spaces that benefit from this program. So the only question that I have actually, I'm not actually sure if you guys will have an answer to this. I'm more curious. So talking about WIC, one of the things that we've learned is that the processing times for WIC applications through Denver Health have been really long. And obviously in this ecosystem, it's quite understandable why that is. I'm glad to see them getting grant money to process those applications, but was just curious if in the application process, if you all have any insight into whether Denver Health feels like they have the ability to start reducing those times, or whether it's just like they're at a loss because of the conditions, if that's something that's on your radar at all. I don't know if it would be. That's my curiosity, and I don't know. If it's something that you haven't thought about deeply, I would completely understand that. I'm just keeping my eye on it because I'm worried about it.
I don't have that information right now.
No, but there's 13 grantees.
For you. Yeah. We can get that for you.
Okay. Yeah, we've been talking to them directly too. Seeing that we're giving them some grant funds for that made me curious.
Certainly look through their application as well and make sure if that was noted.
That would be interesting. I would love to see it. Thank you so much. That was it for me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Parody. And obviously now that question is in the ether, it's out there, and we'll have some follow-ups from the departments that are
answers
impacted.
Will just rain down.
It's there. They're coming.
Actually, can I say one thing to that?
Yes.
There was a retreat, gosh, was it 6 months ago-ish, maybe 9 months ago? The question that you're asking was one of our subcommittee groups. And a lot of conversation around how access happens, how efficient it is, how that's measured. And so the evaluation team that is working has actually, I think, been, and I know we don't have specifics, but it's a really good question. And I know that it's something that the subcommittee and the evaluation team has been working on because it's definitely on the radar.
Awesome.
See you there.
That's a good idea.
Thank you, Council President Pro Tem. Councilmember Flynn online, and then Councilmember Sawyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am somewhat perplexed by the list on slide 14. There is but one of these contracts with a provider that is active in Council District 2, which I know has neighborhoods and households very much in need. And I see a lot of the other providers are spread out through many of the districts. And so I'm curious, I am not familiar with the Hadanu Collective. I'm familiar with Southwest Food Coalition, of course. But we did have, and we worked with Kaizen Food Rescue also, and they have worked with Commune Denver. And Commune Denver has had a contract and an extension with Healthy Food for Denver Kids that the last one expired in July of last year. And I'm curious why that's not on the list, because they have done weekly food distributions at the church in South Denver. And so can you explain, was Commune an applicant and not selected, or did they not apply? And who is the Hadanu Collective? It looks like they're active nationwide. Thank you.
Yeah, Commune is a current grantee of ours, so they are still working in the Southwest Denver area, and they partner with many of these organizations here on this list. And Hadanu Collective is a fiscal sponsor for the Southwest Denver Food Coalition. That's a newer organization, and as a newer 501c3, they're required to have a fiscal sponsor, and so they will be doing the programming and receiving the bulk of the funds, and rather than Hadanu Collective.
And I can add on to that as well. So Commune is currently an 05 cohort grantee. So their contract runs August 2024 to July 2027. And so that's why they're not on the slide, because we're not necessarily approving their contract dollars today, because they're continuing work from an existing grant. We can double check on Kaizen, because I know they do work pretty widely across the city. So it's possible we missed District 2 on that slide. So we could double check and get a response for you on that.
I did not find Commune with a current contract, so I'll do a deeper search. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last one I saw expired in July of 24, but you're telling me they're on a one that runs through 27.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Lynn. Councilmember Sawyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, you guys, so much. You are a fantastic program. So grateful to the voters of Denver for approving this and creating this incredible opportunity for all of our residents. I know that you cannot be everything to everyone, but I will say one of the things that we're seeing in my district is food insecurity for the aging population of residents who are really struggling. Perhaps they're on a fixed income, and you know, the cost of their rent, the cost of living, doesn't allow as much for food costs as it used to. And so I'm curious whether, since we have to go back out to reauthorize the voters eventually at some point anyway, in your strategic conversations operationally or with the board, have you thought about kind of the potential of including different groups, right? Healthy food for Denver kids is amazing, and our Denver kids need this food. So, and I understand you can't be everything to everyone, right? But I'm just curious whether, since we know that this is a very specific population of people, we know that it's a problem for them, and we know that we are an aging state, and so this problem is only going to get worse, whether you have had any conversation around or considered pivoting a little bit to be inclusive of that population in the future.
Yeah, it's a great question. And as you all know, we're walking a line of how much we can do and say as city employees. But certainly, you know, just brainstorming and thinking strategically about what the future of this program or an expansion or extension could look like, it has come up that HFDK is a bit limited in who we can serve. Right. I know that there are community partners you might be aware of, including the Southwest Food Coalition, that has spoken about potential efforts around a wider food justice fund that could cover, say, seniors or older adults in the community, families without children. And so it's definitely on our radar.
Okay. Appreciate that. Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Councilmember Sawyer. And I was going to add to the point, if there is no one else in the queue, I'll make a quick comment. This is an action item, and we'll ask for a motion. But really wanted to say, you know, really thank you. And I think the idea of the multi-generational support that Councilmember Sawyer brought forward may be out of the scope of healthy food for Denver kids, but it's definitely something that needs to be discussed. I can say for Clayton Early Learning, which is an organization deep in and loved within on the east side, 8,000, and I'm going to read, you've served 8,000 families through the Clayton Market. You provided over 65 tons of fresh, frozen, and non-perishable food. And that's often for folks who are invisible to poverty, that folks looking at these families may not be aware. I think your work is so impactful because it goes to the spaces and places where folks can gather food, good, healthy food, and have dignity in doing it. And so I am so proud of your support for organizations like Clayton Early Learning and the good work that you're doing across the city. So thank you so much. This is an action item. We have a vote by block for the year 25 series, starting from 10:20 through 10:31. I won't read each one, but we need a motion and a second by block to move this forward. Moved by Councilmember Torres, second by Councilmember Sawyer. Do we need a acclamation vote? Is this good to go to the floor? Thank you all for your presentation. We look forward to seeing you on the floor, and thank you for the good work that you and your teams do. With that, we move on to a briefing from the Office of Independent Monitor. We'll provide a few minutes for transition. Monitor Lizbeth Perez Castle and your team, if you don't mind coming forward, and we'll give you a few moments to transition. Thank you all so much. Thank it's good you. To see you. And I'll pass these out. Yeah. All right. Okay. Yes. Yes. Sorry. Yes.
Thank you. Okay.
And if there is support needed, oh, I see Ann there already. So.
Yeah.
Where's the best place for me to station myself?
You,
right here?
Right there, wherever you feel comfortable, it's perfect. Is someone moving the slides for you, or are you? All right, perfect. Good deal.
My lovely assistant, Nicole Taylor.
That is excellent. And for committee members and council members and folks viewing, just want to let folks know that Chief Thomas will be having a similar presentation at Mayor Council next Tuesday. And just so you're aware that this is an ongoing dialogue, but this is important to hear from the Office of Independent Monitor today. Elizabeth, whenever you're ready, I'll have you introduce yourself and your team, and then let's dive into the presentation. You have about 30 minutes for the present out.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Elizabeth Bettis Castle. I am the Denver Independent Monitor. With me is Nicole Taylor. She is our community outreach person. Also from our office is the Deputy Director, Greg Crittenden, and our Policy Director, Mr. Spiridon Codelas. Also from COB is Daniel Van Scooten, and also from our office are our outreach team.
And what is COB?
Name it?
What is COB?
Citizen Oversight Board. Yes, I have to remember to do good.
And I see Karen Collier sitting back there as well.
And so Karen, sorry, Karen, I didn't see you. I have timed my presentation as experienced as I am trying to be.
Yes.
Please be patient with me. I have left time at the end of the presentation for questions. And as you said, this is an ongoing dialogue, and we are prepared to have continued dialogue about this. So slide number, go back. What we're here to talk about today is what is called education-based discipline, or sometimes referred to as development. There is a system of discipline for the Denver Police Department and the Denver Sheriff's Department in which violations of rules are addressed through the discipline system. For Denver, it is the Internal Affairs Bureau. For the Sheriff's Department, it is the Administrative Investigations Unit. All complaints that come in from community members are filtered to those agencies, and they conduct the initial investigation when that investigation is done to determine if there was a policy violation, investigate what the allegations are, and determine if there was a policy violation. They do the initial investigation. It is then forwarded to the Office of the Independent Monitor for our review and recommendations. So that is the initial investigatory phase. Then after that, if the case moves forward for discipline, there is a second phase called the disciplinary phase. And that is conducted by the Conduct Review Bureau for DPD. So in terms of the system of discipline, that's kind of an outline, and I'll speak more as to that in a minute. But I want to be clear. The OIM does not support education-based discipline. We do not agree with the approach or believe it is necessary. Additional training that targets demonstrated deficiencies is welcome. Such training should be provided in addition to discipline penalties. There is no best practice research suggesting EBD improves officer accountability or outcomes for community members. EBD removes accountability from discipline. Without accountability, there can be no community trust. This is an attempt to eliminate accountability for the department and oversight in a not-so-veiled attempt. So let me say that again. This is a not-so-veiled attempt to eliminate accountability for officers and the Office of the Independent Monitor. Next slide. What does discipline look like? So we want to talk a little bit about the background of education-based discipline, but I think it's important to very, very quickly kind of identify how this works. So there are all sorts of different types of violations, not filling out a report, all the way to excessive force. There are hundreds of different types of violations. Those violations are then put into a category. And those categories are A through F. A being the less serious, that can be kind of an oral reprimand or a written reprimand, all the way to F, which is most likely termination. So that's what we're talking about, A, B, C, D, E, F. What EBD is attempting to do is, instead of disciplining officers, is providing training. So for background on EBD, the general idea is to replace some discipline penalties with training that addresses the specific misconduct identified. There is no best practice research indicating that EBD reduces officer recidivism, serves a stronger deterrent than traditional discipline, or makes community members and officers safer. EBD has not been recognized as a best practice by IACP, which stands for International Association of Chiefs of Police, PERF, Police Executive Research Forum, and DOJ, the Department of Justice. This model of discipline, which is really not discipline, was created by Sheriff Leroy Baca of the LA Sheriff's Department and implemented in 2009. Sheriff Baca created a system where officers would not be disciplined for violations, but instead would receive training. What we know about Sheriff Baca is that he was in charge of a jail in which prisoners were being abused, bribery was rampant, and intimidation of FBI agents. The FBI and the DOJ then prosecuted Sheriff Baca for obstruction of justice and false statements based upon his role in the above scheme. He was convicted for a felony. He served 3 years prison. These details are important in order for you to put in context who created EBD and his potential motivation. I want to talk about how EBD was rolled out here to the OIM and to the community. In early December, I was presented with a PowerPoint during a coffee meeting, not with the chief, but with a member of his staff, for a proposed model, but not an actual draft of the policy. So it was a PowerPoint. The draft is the actual language of the policy. PowerPoint is not policy. The actual draft is the policy. This PowerPoint, we later learned, had been shared with a very few small group of community members as early as October, before we were ever even told about it. By January 1st, we learned the new policy would be effective immediately. We didn't, at the OIM, even receive a copy of the draft until January 2nd. Yet we were being told this was going forward. That is in violation of the ordinance that requires that the OIM review any significant changes in policy that have that significantly impact the office of the OIM or oversight. The OIM then made recommendations on March 19th. Per ordinance, the OIM must have an opportunity to review and make recommendations on any law enforcement policy that impacts oversight. This is such a policy. And as it seems, because there was originally some community engagement, without ever discussing with the OIM the reasons for this, or the purpose, or attempting to see if there's something that the departments could work out, they went ahead and basically did it without us. This was very calculated. Next slide. Oversight assessments of jurisdictions using EBD. So what have other agencies that I'm going to quote for some of oversight agencies determined other problems with EBD? The Office of Police Complaints overseeing the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. EBD in lieu of discipline demonstrates to officers that complaints from community members are insignificant and implies to the community that MPD endorses or at least tolerates police misconduct, further driving a wedge between citizens and the police. 2024. As discussed previously, there is no best practice for EBD. At least two of these cities have that we have looked at have an oversight model and have addressed this. The chief recently, I believe it was on July 9th, in an address to Civil Service Commission regarding EBD, acknowledged there is currently no program tracking the success of EBD. Next slide, please. Oversight assessments of jurisdictions using EBD. Special counsel to the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. This is the same department that created EBD. We conclude that the EBD program is well-intentioned, but is, in practice, overbroad and overused. EBD was not able to prevent or minimize disturbing instances of apparent misconduct by deputies and supervisors. It adds fuel to the fire of those who allege that law enforcement is unwilling to punish and overly willing to protect its own. In its present form, we cannot endorse EBD. Semiannual Report 2013. Next slide, please. DPD discipline. It is a somewhat complicated system, but again, you have your violations, they fall into a category, and then the category is what determines. There is a matrix, and the matrix says, okay, if this offense falls under this category, this is the presumptive punishment, this is the mitigated punishment, and this is the aggravated punishment. Police officers hold a position of trust, a trust bestowed upon them by the community. Because of the trust placed in them, officers must know that when they engage in misconduct, they will receive fair and appropriate discipline. An effective disciplinary system is fairly administered, reasonably consistent, and based upon department-wide standards. Ensures both clarity in expectations and accountability for actions by the individual officer. This results in strengthened relationships and increased levels of trust with the community. This is directly out of the discipline handbook. The stated purpose, there have been many stated purposes by the department as to why they want to move to EBD. The number one reason seems to be that EBD should be used to reduce the amount of time it takes for many disciplinary cases to come to conclusion. I've heard that it takes anywhere from 6 months to 9 months, depending on who is giving the presentation. My concern is the only way to shorten the discipline process without mutual engagement is to eliminate oversight, is to eliminate investigations. Per ordinance, the Office of the Independent Monitor, must review investigations and certify that they are thorough and complete. If you remove our review function, you have the police policing themselves. I do not disagree that the length of time seems too long. However, a thorough and complete investigation takes time. Oversight takes time. This is not a bad thing. At no time has a community member ever approached me and said, you know what, my complaint takes too much time. I think we should just do away with discipline. Will oversight be where the time is eliminated? I suggest that is exactly what will happen. This remains to be seen because we have not seen the final draft. So, and I'll talk about that more in a minute. The current discipline handbook addresses the importance of community involvement in accountability. These discipline declarations are contained in the most recent discipline handbook from 2022. What do they require? Trust from community. This recognizes the longstanding comment number two, that it ensures both clarity and expectations, recognizes a longstanding understanding that for law enforcement to be legitimized, It must have the trust of the community. It says they will be disciplined because we know without discipline, there is no accountability. An effective disciplinary system, it must require accountability to do so. I have heard the chief saying training is accountability. The problem with that is I disagree, as that is not as written in the disciplinary rules. It is not as written in the matrix. Training is a part of the disciplinary process. But further, it does not address the harm committed to community. Accountability is one thing. And so if the argument is, well, they have to do training, that is accountability. Well, what about the harm to the community? How do they get satisfied? How do they know that this isn't going to happen again? How do they know that they can have confidence in how it's being addressed? I do not believe it addresses the harm. Further, the operations manual, there are several different subsections. An effective disciplinary system results in strengthened relationships, increased levels of trust. But more importantly, discipline should reflect the mission and values of the department and promote respect and trust within the department and with the community. Training, mentoring, and the like, section 5.1, are means to affect the performance of conduct of officers apart from the imposition of disciplinary sanctions and to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of the disciplinary system. However, none of these is intended to relieve officers of responsibility for their misconduct. 6.3, the impact of future status and benefits to the officer should not be regarded as part of the discipline system. 6.4, financial impact should not be considered. And the reason I bring up those subsections is because those are some of the arguments that are made in community as to why EBD is necessary. There must be trust of the system with community. Community members have made it very clear to myself and our office, they do not trust this new model. For trust to be given, it must be earned. Next slide, please. The discipline matrix was created to, among other things, make sure that disciplinary penalties are reasonably consistent, eliminate any unjustifiable disparities between discipline findings, hold officers accountable. The current disciplinary system serves the public and the officers and the administration by uniformly reinforcing acceptable standards of conduct and presenting a clear methodology for consequences related to a failure to abide by such standards. The department recognizes it must hold officers accountable. This language comes, again, from the discipline handbook. So in their own handbook, it says the department recognizes it must hold officers accountable. Chief recently addressed the Civil Service Commission on July 9th, and he acknowledged that EBD is not discipline. However, he argues training equals accountability. How can you hold someone accountable when they do not have to acknowledge their misconduct or the harm caused? And I should back up here a second. When we talk about EBD, if an officer is not disciplined but instead gets EBD, there is no finding, there is no sustained finding that they did anything wrong. They don't have to admit to it, they don't have to apologize, they don't have to do anything. It's just EBD. So when you say that it's accountability, what about the harm caused to the community member? The argument has been made that the current system is overly punitive, that alternatives from the private sector should be modeled for police discipline. So I guess it's some form of redirecting behavior, some sort of behavioral management. Not a lot of folks in the private sector carry guns that can end someone's life in an instant. I don't think that that's a fair comparison. Want to discuss reasons for EBD as reported to the community. It has been stated that EBD will only be for minor violations. What we have heard is that that would be violations A through C. Those are written reprimand, oral reprimand, up to 1 or 2 days. Since we don't have the final draft, it's still in draft form, we don't know what is meant exactly by minor violations. A minor violation may be something, one thing to the department. It can be something completely different to the OIM or the citizen. What if the category of violation changes? For example, use of force. So we adopt this system. Currently, use of force is a category D violation. But there's nothing to keep them from changing that or parsing it out later or taking pieces out and putting it someplace else. And actually, use of force is an A, use of force used to be D. Now it's categorized as A through F, which means it can run the whole gamut. That was a change that was made, again, without consultation with the OIM. The chief has stated these violations will not show in the system as sustained violations. Under the current matrix, if an officer has a prior sustained violation within a certain amount of time, that sustained violation can be used to aggravate subsequent conduct. So what they're proposing is a change to the matrix. Since there will be no sustained finding, an officer cannot, in fact, have an aggravated penalty for previous conduct if it were given EBD because it wasn't a sustained finding. EBD does not impact the ability to participate in the promotional process. So you can have EBD violations, you can be on a plan for EBD, and you can get promoted. So a violation of policy under EBD will continue to allow you to get promoted, not allow aggravation as is listed in the matrix now. And that argument, further, the argument has been made to community that it will reduce recidivism. What offenses are contemplated as recidivism? Are we talking about the same exact violation? Is it a category of violation? So is EBD a freebie? So you violate a policy, you get EBD, you violate a policy again, same policy or another policy, then that becomes the first violation. So and then on the third time you violate policy, that becomes the second violation. That is a way to attempt to show that they've addressed recidivism. I'm not aware that recidivism is an issue for our department. Another reason presented to community in these PowerPoints is for better recruitment. Do we want to recruit officers who do not wish to be held accountable? Also, that it helps morale by reducing embitterment at the levels of discipline and therefore slow down of work. Is that the kind of department we want? Are those the kind of officers we want? Who are angry because they get disciplined? Next slide, please. DPD discipline. Education and training is a practice in support of the current DPD disciplinary system. In cases where an officer is under investigation for misconduct, or has been found to have committed misconduct, additional training, in addition to the possible imposition of discipline, should be considered. Again, directly out of the handbook. EBD has the potential, my position is, EBD has the potential to upend the current DPD disciplinary system by eliminating the possible imposition of discipline for certain misconduct violations. And in my opinion, the only way to do that is to eliminate oversight. Education and training are already part of the discipline system. I can't say that enough. It's already there. They're just choosing not to use it. Training, in addition to any possible imposition of discipline, should be considered. That's what the handbook says. It states very clearly training can be a part of the discipline together with sustained findings and acceptance of responsibility. We have not seen the final draft of this policy, so we cannot say exactly what the misconduct violations will be. Next slide, please. Deliberative process privilege. Deliberative process privilege is codified in our ordinance. And what it essentially says is that communications and negotiations and reviews and recommendations to the departments cannot be discussed in public. I cannot share with the community a copy of the draft or drafts that I have received or our recommendations. DPP, as it's called, prevents OIM from talking about the proposed DPD EBD policy we have seen and analyzed, the specific OIM recommendations to the proposed DPD EBD policy, and whether public presentations and statements from DPD staff about the proposed EBD program align with DPD EBD policy we have seen and analyzed. Deliberative privilege process prohibits the OIM from disclosing any draft, and the importance of that we will continue to discuss. It is frustrating to our office to not be able to engage with community the way that the department has by going out and presenting this PowerPoint and this program. It is like trying to stem the tsunami with one hand handcuffed behind my back. It is frustrating to the community. DPD has had opportunity to make presentations regarding EBD, but we're prevented from telling anyone what our recommendations are. However, we can, as we are doing today, make our concerns known. What has been the OIM's engagement regarding EBD with community members? During the OIM's engagement with community members, they have shared their concern and frustration regarding the lack of transparency on the proposed EBD program by DPD. The community requested that a draft of the EBD policy be shared with community members and the City Council for their review, input, and guidance. The community requested that any implementation of EBD be delayed until the draft policy has been shared publicly and an opportunity for meaningful community feedback has been provided. The OIM agrees with the community that substantive changes to the disciplinary process should not happen unilaterally. July 9th, again, to the Civil Service Commission, the chief said he was proceeding with this unilaterally. Engaging with the community is not a politeness. It is not a courtesy. It is the best practice to promote community trust as set forth in President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, 2015. This decision should not be made unilaterally. I want to first acknowledge that not all communities are impacted the same by policing. So when Chief says, well, I have engaged with community, you have to take a hard look at who that community was, because different communities have different experiences and are impacted differently by law enforcement. How can a community, and he claims that their support for it were overwhelming support. How can a community genuinely give input to a policy they have never seen? All anybody's ever seen is a PowerPoint. Together Colorado, which the chief indicates he has consulted with, has indicated to me it does not have enough information about the discipline process and EBD to make a recommendation that but they have asked to engage in further conversation. So they were presented a PowerPoint presentation, an unexpected PowerPoint presentation, and They're not familiar necessarily with the discipline system, but they agree to engage in further conversation. That is what I have heard from some other groups as well. In order for you, city council members, to adequately represent your constituents and communities, to consider the value of this change, you need to know what that policy says. Is it good for Denver? Is it good for your community? This is an issue of transparency. Why can't the community be trusted to give input? Next slide. DPD policies and Denver community engagement. In 2008, the current model of discipline was adopted with significant community input and guidance. The discipline matrix was designed through extensive input from representatives of the police department, city management, appointed officials, legal advisors, and concerned members of the public. Talking about, I have provided a copy for all of you of the manager's report adopting the matrix system that was implemented in 2008, the one that we're currently working under now. It is also available on the Citizen Oversight Board website under historical documents. Beginning in 2005, the Manager's Safety Disciplinary Advisory Group began its work on the current matrix discipline system. This was led by Al LeCabe, former state federal prosecutor and the director, and he was also director of safety. At least 116 members of community, city council, academia, law enforcement, and the police union engaged over 3 years forming subgroups to create our current level of discipline. This report identifies best practices based upon research, studies of other discipline models. I will add that one of the models that they reviewed was EBD out of Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. I can provide the specific end note later. There were many subgroups formed to address all aspects of discipline. Hundreds and hundreds of hours, sweat, tears went into our current matrix system. The final product of that was a creation of the matrix discipline system we work with today. The community and law enforcement agreed upon this system as it reflected the expectations of the community. The adoption of the matrix was a contract between law enforcement and the community regarding discipline. To change that model unilaterally is a betrayal of trust and a betrayal of the agreement. EBD fails to meet any of these standards. Fast forward to 2017. In 2017, the use of force, the department was attempting to change the use of force policy. They published the draft. Community was involved. There was extensive community input regarding that. And then eventually that policy was published. Fast forward 2025. They have not published a draft or shared it with the community, even though they have been asked to over and over again. The community has expressed its request for the following steps to be taken before EBD is adopted. Share the draft policy. Next. EBD program requirements. The OIM does not support EBD. However, if the DPD decides to move forward with an EBD program, the community should ensure that the following minimum requirements are met. Prohibit the use of EBD for all cases with conduct category D through F, including allegations of inappropriate force. Require the establishment and documentation of criteria for determining if a case qualifies for EBD. Require consensus between CRB, that is the Conduct Review Bureau for IAB, and the OIM when determining what path cases are going to take. Ensure all EBD cases receive thorough and complete investigations certified by the OIM. The OIM must certify that the investigation is thorough and complete. That is our function. Require that, next slide. require that the Department of Safety and DPD share draft EBD agreements with the OIM for review before finalizing as required by Denver Revised Municipal Code 2389. I will add here, last night at a very late hour, I was forwarded another draft of the policy by the chief. I have not had the opportunity to analyze it or review it. Require that EBD cases have sustained findings and are used to escalate penalties in future cases. Prohibit EBD agreements from requiring training that an officer has already completed, and ensure that EBD training is not substituted for already required in-service training. Require that the complainants be provided the information that the officer completed EBD training in lieu of discipline and closure letters. Require that EBD is scientifically evaluated and shown to produce positive outcomes for the Denver community, and that there be a deadline for that. Closing statements. As I stated, we were never approached about trying to minimize the timeliness aspect. We are more than happy to work with the department to see if we can help with that. But again, you do not throw the baby out with the bathwater. If this policy is published, I guarantee you the OIM will review it, analyze it, and report on it, and we will continue to report on it and let the community know. Should the city of Denver be the guinea pig for police discipline? Does that inspire trust? Does that inspire safety? Once more, is the community willing to be a part of an unproven experiment? A decision about their policing made unilaterally? Do we eliminate accountability for the sake of timeliness? The Denver community has experienced the evolution of discipline in DPD. The catalyst for community-based oversight was the death of Paul Childs, along with many others at the hands of police. It was based on a system that felt as if it protected officers at the expense of the community safety. The community cried out, demanded transparency and accountability before law enforcement could be legitimized in their hearts and minds. We hear that same cry today. They fought hard to put together a system that made officers accountable and was just. And now, 17 years later, after the adoption of the Matrix, the painful history of police misconduct comes back again. Here we are again. The past is not that far behind us. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Thank you, and I open it up for questions.
Thank you so much, Independent Monitor Perez Castle. We have five council members in the queue for questions. We have 10 minutes remaining for our committee. We start first with Councilmember Gonzalez Gutierrez.
I think Parity was first.
Councilmember Parity is asked to drop out of the queue.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
I will be very quick so that other people can ask questions. And you actually, as I was like writing questions, you were then answering them. So thank you for that presentation. I will just mention Councilman Cashman pinged me before he left. He wanted to apologize that he had to leave early. He asked me to deliver this message on this important discussion. He cannot tolerate any weakening of the role of the Independent Monitor or Citizen Oversight Board. So he just wanted to make that known on the record. And so I just wanted to translate that.
Thank you.
I guess one quick question I have, because you went over the history of how the current policy was created, which was one of my questions. And I guess here's I guess the question, and I don't know if you can answer this, is were any of your from the Office of Independent Monitor, the recommendations that have been made thus far, knowing that you cannot necessarily share them with us, do you know if any of them have been adopted in the policy? And it sounds like you got a more recent version.
9:38 last night.
Okay.
So I haven't had a chance to look at it.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. And then I guess one last quick question is, has there, what has
been, and if I can just say, yeah. It's not just adopting our recommendations. Some recommendations have much more value, are much more important than others.
Okay. And I guess you had mentioned your initial, how you were first brought into the conversation. It was kind of a quick meeting you had over coffee.
It was after the fact.
What has been engagement and conversation been like since that initial conversation?
With the OIM?
Yes.
So
with you and DPD about the policy.
We have provided recommendations.
So like just back and forth,
yes.
Writing. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Councilmember. Councilmember Sawyer, and then Councilmember Torres.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Monitor, for being here and for sharing your concerns with us. I think that it's really important for us to hear them. I am very concerned about the way this committee has gone down. This is our first one, and it's a switchover. And so maybe there was a little bit of kind of miscommunication or something, but I have a lot of questions. Most of them are for DPD. They should be in this room. That they are not here is extremely concerning to me. That we had 7 minutes for council member questions around this is extremely concerning to me. So this is not a reflection of you all at all. And I truly don't know how this went down. So it's not a reflection of you either.
We didn't speak to it as well.
Please
but continue.
I want to make it very clear that it is not okay that we are having this conversation like this. DPD needs to be in the room to have an opportunity to answer questions. Community needs to be in the room to have an opportunity to share their thoughts and feedback and public comment. So I have a lot of questions on this. I'm not happy that we have been put in this position as council members. And so I really appreciate everything that you're saying, and I hear you, and I think it is so incredibly important. I also think it is incredibly unfair that DPD is not in the room to share their thoughts. So I would like to ask that we come back for a full committee with public comment and additional opportunity and DPD in the room for a full conversation about what this actually looks like and where there might be bridges that can be built and things that can be crossed. This is not okay. And I'm going to stop there because we only have 5 minutes left.
Correct.
And there are other members in the queue.
And I'll be very quick, Councilmember Sawyer. We had a full discussion of kind of what the correct cadence for a presentation like this should be. We had a full dialogue. This presentation was on the agenda. We know that the normal process or cadence would have required for Denver Police to be present, for there to be community informed. That is the way this committee will be delivered going forward. Denver Police will be speaking at Mayor Council next week. They stated, and let me finish, they stated that for today, that they were not going to be present at the committee because the timing would not allow for a full dialogue. We respected the process. I hear you, and we're going to definitely work with Council President and with everyone else to ensure that we have going forward within this committee, and I'm meeting with each of the departments that report up to health and safety. We have a specific cadence, a briefing process. We have a full process that we're rolling out. So heard you clearly, and we're going to work towards making sure that we have full discussion. Council President?
So when we got the letter from the Citizen Oversight Board, I forwarded that to the chief and said, hey, I didn't know where this was in the queue, and asked that before it is implemented, can we please get briefed? I was told that this was coming to this committee, and which I was like, okay, great. And then I was also told that they wouldn't be here simultaneously.
Yep.
So I said, okay, and he agreed not to roll anything out until we'd gotten briefed. So the soonest he could get on an agenda was Mayor Council. That's what I came up with. That was my idea of him coming to Mayor Council because this committee agenda was full and they weren't coming here simultaneously. I've been doing my best to figure out how to get everybody in the queue. So I would just have to say that we'll probably have to come again and have a full conversation.
And so let's not deliberate more on this. Council President is exactly correct as to what the process is. We will, Council Member Sawyer, we you're heard. We had very specific discussions on this, and this is on the process we're going. We appreciate the independent monitor for being here. I want to make sure we get to the council members that are in the queue.
Mr. Chair, I'm really sorry, but can I just respond as the former chair and to explain the conversations that
Councilmember Gonzalez-Gutierrez, please, as quickly as possible, and then let's
just
move
so
to the queue.
For great frame of reference to your point, is that this has actually been in the queue for several months and been asking Department of Safety multiple conversations with Elizabeth, I'm sorry, with Emily Lauck about bringing this to committee. I had one conversation with the chief where I was provided no documentation about this proposed policy, and I asked about them coming to committee, and I asked several times. I was told that then it would be going. We kept making space for it, but it just, they weren't ready. And then I was approached by the independent monitor, and I said, okay, well, maybe this will coincide with one another. I had mistakenly thought that mayor council, we were getting that yesterday, so I thought it would coincide with that presentation and then this presentation, because I was not given the information of when it was actually happening, even though I had asked for it. So I just wanted to let you know that I was trying to coordinate it as best as I could, and then we transitioned. And I appreciate Councilman Watson. I just don't want him to get any of the like blame or anything for anything.
And we're going to
move forward. There's clearly a lot going on here, but let's come back with a full conversation.
So Councilmember Torres, please.
Thank you so much. I feel like even before that negotiation started, DPD should have been in here talking about what's being proposed. So just want to lay that out. I want to be understanding, I think, some of the ordinance and charter language that have been referenced, just so I can also begin to piece together. If things are evolving on the department side, I think they need to evolve on the monitor oversight language side as well. And so I want to be able to track what that looks like. So I could only find in the charter section 12.1.1 that references you may make recommendations regarding policy issues. I didn't see anything where departments, safety departments, whether it's fire and police or sheriff, have to present to you policy changes before they are implemented. So just something that I'm flagging and would love to know if there's other references to that.
Yeah, I will send it to you.
Perfect. What I do find interesting, and it's on page 31 of the report that you shared at the very bottom, and it continues to 32, is that this DAG, Steering Committee and the Manager of Safety, fully accepted and endorsed the charter mandated concept of consistent discipline to help ensure that similarly situated officers are treated similarly and that disciplinary decisions are not the result of discrimination or any other inappropriate influence. That's big language to me that I'm grateful is in this. And I just saw this now, right? I haven't even really read this. So I also want to be sure I'm understanding, as we get more information, how whatever is being proposed complies with this. Because this is just as important to, I think, us as it should be to everyone else in the city. Council President and I have convened a group to look at the charter language for Civil Service Commission, which is referenced quite a bit in this language as well as in current charter. So it would be really helpful to understand, I think, the layers of influence that things speak to back and forth between ordinance and between charter. So we have a good sense of where things moving and how are things being interpreted between the two. So thank you very much. And I don't blame you at all for being the tip of the spear on this. And somebody had to come to us at some point, and I'm just grateful you had the independence to do that. So thank you, Monitor.
Thank you, Councilmember Torres. Councilmember Flynn.
Monitor Castle, if you have a handout that you distributed to folks at the table, could you leave one with the committee analysts to put in my mailbox upstairs, and I will pick it up when I come back downtown. I appreciate that. Given we only have 2 minutes left, Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I would, rather than having a presentation at Mayor Council, I would like Chief Thomas to come in and present on this, because it's very awkward to be hearing such a strong condemnation of a policy on which We have not been fully briefed and given no data. When we got the Citizen Oversight Board email, I, like Council President, I also contacted the chief and I said, what is this all about? And he sent me a response that I thought was very well explains the overarching purpose and how it will be implemented. But I think we need a lot more data before I can say, wow, this is really terrible, or wow, this is something that might be good. And so I want to see Chief come in maybe for a full committee meeting, Mr. Chair, so that we can have a good back and forth and dialogue before we form any opinion about this. And I did forward the chief's reply to me to all council members during this meeting, so you can read what the chief sent me. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vice Chair Flynn. Council members, I just want to say, and for folks viewing, this is a sausage making. There is a transition process. We've had robust discussions in between being aware that this was on the agenda, and know that your points of interest we've heard you. We will work with Council President to ensure that there is a full committee presentation from both the chief and a clear response and presentation at Mayor Council next week. With that, we have one consent item on the agenda and nothing else being seen. Thank you so much for a fun first health and safety meeting. Thank you. Thank you.